Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It's no surprise that in a country that defines itself by its liberty, we love to settle arguments by quoting the Bill of Rights. But while those first 10 amendments seem to capture the essence of a society built on freedom, we continue to debate what the men now known as the founders intended with each of them. As my guest will tell us, probing the founders' intent can lead us to a surprising conclusion. The Bill of Rights came about in large part as a response to simmering threats to the authority of a federal government that at the time didn't even possess the power to enforce it. In short, political ploy first, statement of principle second. Carol Birkin is presidential professor of history at Baruch College and a member of the history faculty at the Graduate Center at City University of New York. Her new book is The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. Carol, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you.
This book was a fascinating introduction to me to the idea that the meaning of the Bill of Rights has changed a great deal over the centuries. This was a document really passed to shore up loyalty to a government that states and citizens weren't quite sure they had a lot of allegiance to.
That's absolutely true. I think Americans today think that the Constitution was passed and then everybody agreed this was a great government and we went on to fame and fortune. But in fact, many, many people thought it was a terrible idea. Several very important people wanted to get rid of it or eviscerate its powers. And the people who founded it weren't sure it was going to last very long.
I don't mean to make the comparison between the Constitution and the Affordable Care Act, but it seems as if that's it's comparable in some ways, that it was passed and done and even in place. And yet there were lots of people who thought this is just temporary. We can get rid of this thing.
Exactly, exactly.
So for years after we passed and ratified the Constitution, detractors were pushing to throw it out and start over. Why was starting over and working on a brand new Constitution to fix the things that some people didn't like such a risky proposition for this fragile new union?
Well, it was risky because the people who wanted a second convention, people like Patrick Henry and Samuel Adams, and they actually wanted to reestablish the sovereignty of the states. Patrick Henry is a perfect example. For his entire life, he referred to Virginia as his country. And these were, I call them provincial. I don't mean by that they had out-of-date haircuts. I mean their devotion was to their province, to their locality. You can call them localists, I suppose, if you want. They wanted most of the power that a government could have to stay with the states. And by that, they meant the power to tax, the power to regulate commerce, the power to set currency of their own, each state to have its own money, sort of the way Europe was before the European Common Market. If you went from Rhode Island to Virginia, the value of your Rhode Island money before the Constitution was passed was probably zilch. So I think that the men who wanted a second convention, what they really wanted to do was roll back the powers that had been given to the federal government. They wanted to take away its power to tax. They wanted to take away its power to regulate commerce. They wanted to take away its power to create a uniform currency and really return to the first Constitution of the United States, which was the Articles of Confederation, that was really a league of friendship among 13 sovereign nations, 13 independent nations. It took a very long time for Americans to think of themselves as Americans. They really did think of themselves as Virginians or New Yorkers or Connecticut men and women. They were not nationalists in the way that we think of ourselves today, or most of us think of ourselves today. And I think the second convention, the idea of a second convention, made people like Washington, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, Gouverneur Morris, Robert Morris, made them terrified because they knew what it would mean was to roll back all of these powers that they thought a federal government had to have if the country was going to survive.
Carol, how did it become apparent that the Articles of Confederation would not be sufficient and that we would have to go for something like the Constitution we ended up with?
Right. A lot of people think the Articles of Confederation, they just dismiss it. They say, weak. The Constitution was strong. I've seen teachers put this up on a blackboard, weak, strong. But in fact, that's not the way to think about it. The Articles of Confederation really satisfied the goals of the Revolution, which were for every single colony that became a state to be sovereign, to be its own power, its own authority. And representative government, when you said no taxation without representation, they meant without being taxed by their own local representatives in their own assembly. The problem with governments formed based on what you want in a revolution is the morning after the revolution, you have to govern. And very quickly, many leaders of the country realized that this was not going to work. Every single state had its own import and export duties. So if you wanted to send something from Rhode Island, I keep picking on Rhode Island, I shouldn't, Connecticut, down to South Carolina, at every state border you had to pay an export tax and an import tax, and you had to change your money. So that by the time whatever you were selling got to where you wanted to sell it, it was impossible to make a profit. I like to tell my students how extreme this sense of independence was. Maryland and Virginia had gunboats aimed at each other on the Potomac to stop anything being brought between the two states without export and import duties. This made it impossible for the American economy to recover after the post-war depression began when the Revolution was over. We also did not have any centralized army anymore. Americans were very hostile to the idea of a standing army, a permanent army, because of their experiences with the British army. So Indians on the border, no protection except your local state militia. The British were still in the forts in the west. The Spanish were to our south. America was a very fragile and not very important country compared to the great powers of Europe. And in fact, on the eve of the Constitutional Convention, the French ambassador is writing home to his superior, what part of the United States would you like when we divide it up? So without an army, without protection, without a diplomatic corps, really, who could negotiate treaties, and most of all, the country was pretty much a deadbeat country. We owed money to France. We owed money to Holland. We owed money to Spain. We owed money to our own soldiers from the Continental Army. We owed money to widows and civilians who had given livestock or supplies of some sort or crops to the American military. And since the Articles of Confederation government had no power to tax, they could request money from the states. Well, you know how well that worked. They couldn't pay their debts, and foreign countries viewed them with contempt. And they were trying to borrow more money. And you can imagine the response of Holland when John Adams went over and he said, could we borrow some more money? And the Dutch said, no, we don't think so till you start paying us back what you owe us. So and in addition, without the British Navy protecting our ships on the ocean, Americans were very excited. Oh, now we can ship our products anywhere we want to. They sort of forgot that the British Navy protected our merchant marine. And without that, well, pirates and anybody who wanted to were capturing American ships at will, really. I always pictured Johnny Depp, you know, taking over an American ship loaded down with wheat. And along the Barbary Coast, that is the northern coast of Africa, as American ships went through the Straits of Gibraltar to bring wheat to Italy to make that delicious fattening pasta, the Barbary, we called them the Barbary Pirates, stopped these ships anytime they wanted to, captured the crew, took the the produce on board and said, we'll ransom the crew back to America. And the American government said, I'm sorry, we can't afford to pay you. So things were really quite dismal. And a man like George Washington referred to the Articles of Confederation. He said, our government is a mere shadow. He was afraid, very seriously afraid, that either the country would implode, that is, Maryland and Virginia would go to war with one another, and Connecticut and New Jersey, who were being robbed blind by New York. Goods came into the port of New York, and New York charged exorbitant rates. And there was a rumor that New Jersey and Connecticut were meeting secretly to invade New York City. I live in New York City, and every weekend that actually happens. People come in from the other states
to see a show, but, to go to dinner.
Right, right, and take up all our parking spots.
Right.
The fear was civil wars would break out everywhere, that is, between states, or that slave rebellions would take place, or what happened in 1786, disgruntled farmers in Massachusetts rose up against their government. So there was a danger in their minds that anarchy was going to take over, or we were going to be invaded by powerful foreign countries and divvied up between France and England and Spain. And so when they go to Philadelphia to this convention to amend the Articles of Confederation, but the first thing they do is throw it out and start over again, these men are not optimistic. They're not certain of what they're going to do. They don't know America is going to be the greatest country in the world. They're scared to death. They are frightened that they cannot come up with a way to save this crazy experiment in representative government. And when they're done, they're not sure that people are going to ratify it. And after it's ratified, they're not sure that people are going to pay any attention to it. So these are perilous, anxiety-producing times for the men that we, with great respect, but also absurd amounts of admiration for how confident they were, that we call the Founding Fathers.
So, Carol, you've done a spectacular job laying out the arguments for having a reasonably strong national framework of government, a federal government. What about the anti-federalist side? What were their biggest concerns about having just such a structure to prevent all the terrible things that you've just illuminated for us?
Americans, I don't want to say they were paranoid, but let's say they were extremely anxious about tyranny. They believed that the King of England was corrupted by his ministers. They believed that people who got power craved more power. They had a very dismal view about human nature, probably a realistic one. And so they thought that the way to preserve the liberty that people had fought 8 years for, the way to preserve it was to have the people who had any power over you live among you, earn their living like you did, and serve in the local assembly, and you could watch them. You could make sure that they weren't doing anything that would produce tyranny. People have to remember that this is before the great revolutions in communication and transportation of the 19th century. It took 2 weeks to get from Boston to Philadelphia on horseback. People were traveling on Indian trails.
Let me jump in here 1 second. I want to finish in a second, but we have to take a quick break. My guest is Carol Burkin. Her new book is called The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Carol Birkin, who is presidential professor of history at Baruch College and a member of the history faculty of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Her new book is called The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Before the break, Carol, you were telling us that not only were people who had just passed the revolution and lived through colonial times really worried about tyranny, they were also worried about losing track of what some distant government might be doing, supposedly in their names.
Exactly. I mean, after all, they just fought a war against a distant government. They didn't want another one. If you lived in Georgia and the government was located, the capital, in New York City, it may as well be on the moon. You were not likely to find out what was going on. There's no TV, no internet, no radio, no telegraph even, and very few newspapers in most parts of the country. And so the Anti-Federalists are extremely concerned about giving any power to a centralized government, to a government that they called it an energetic government, one that had too much power, because they were convinced that the protection of their rights and liberties lay with men who they knew, men who they lived near, men who they could point their finger at and say, you shouldn't do that. So this is a very real, this is not a crackpot idea. This is a very real idea. The problem is that most likely the country would not have survived if these people had won. They also thought only really rich people would ever be able to serve in that government, that rich people would take over the country and oppress everybody. They thought the president would become a king. Thomas Jefferson opposed the Constitution. He wrote a 20-page attack on it, and he said, the president should only serve 1 year because otherwise he'll become a tyrant. Of course, when Jefferson became president and served 8 years, he thought that was okay. The country was in good hands. But there were a lot of people worried about these things. They were worried that the federal government would create an army, and the army would march on a state and attack people if they didn't do what the federal government wanted them to do. So anti-federalists were people who thought government should stay local. They believed in state sovereignty. These issues are alive today. I don't probably need to tell any listener to the show that the argument about where ultimate power ought to lie is just as lively today. It has never been resolved. Federalism is a very wacky idea because it says one government has some powers, another government has other powers, and some powers they share. Alexander Hamilton got up in the convention and he said, this is really not going to work. The only thing we can do is abolish the states. And you can imagine people saying, sit down, Alex, take your medicine, you know. But he was, in many ways, as he was about many things, prescient. I mean, much of American history is built on this conflict, the nullification controversy, the Civil War. Orville Faubus standing at the schoolhouse door saying, I don't care what the Supreme Court says, Arkansas isn't going to integrate schools. This fight over where authority ought to lie is part of American history.
There had been some discussion, Carol, of something like a Bill of Rights around the time of the Constitutional Convention, for the Constitution that we did, in fact, pass and ultimately ratify. Why was it shot down at that point?
Everybody wanted to go home. It's really very simple. You don't have to have a very elaborate analysis. They'd been living in taverns, sleeping two and three to a bed, eating tavern food, which was sort of made fast food restaurants look like gourmet places. They were far from their homes, their wives, their children, their businesses, their law practices, their farms. they had been arguing and discussing and arguing and discussing in the heat of Philadelphia. I once had a student who said, why didn't they turn on the air conditioning? They were miserable and they wanted to go home. And George Mason stands up and says, we ought to have a Bill of Rights. And everybody groans. And he says, oh, it'll only take an hour or so. Well, they knew nothing only took an hour in that convention. And finally, Roger Sherman stands up and he saves the day. He said, this Constitution doesn't give the new government any authority over people's rights and liberties. All those are in the hands of the states. Why should we pass laws saying we won't do something that we have no power to do? Everybody said, great, I'm packed, I'm going home. It was sensible, but it was a terrible, terrible tactical mistake, because this was one of the strongest arguments the Anti-Federalists used against ratifying the Constitution. And James Madison realized, the light bulb went over his head very quickly after the convention, and he said, that was a big mistake. Even if we don't have the authority, people want to hear that the federal government does not intend to infringe their rights and liberties. We better do something. And once he thought that, he never gave up on it.
And so the things that Madison pulled into what would eventually become the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, were not ideas that would have shocked anyone. He wasn't saying anything that was radically different from what the average American sort of agreed was a good idea. Is that right?
Absolutely. Much of it was sort of common law practice, legal practice that Americans had grown up with for almost 200 years as colonies of Great Britain. A good bit of it was in every state. That was one of the arguments. 8 of the states had a statement of the people's rights and liberties at the beginning of their constitutions. These were things that people expected. What wasn't in these amendments was taking away any of the powers of the federal government. So what Madison does is he controls what kinds of amendments are going to be proposed to the states for ratification. There's nothing in there about limiting the power of the government to tax. There's nothing in there about limiting the power of the government to regulate commerce. He's very smart, because those are some of the things that the Anti-Federalists wanted amended. But he puts in things that the average American voter would say, yes, that's a right and a liberty that I have. He's a brilliant politician. He really is.
Meanwhile, for elected officials, it should surprise no one, a lot of this was about money and about revenue generation and whether that would belong to the states or the federal government. We still have this sort of uneasy mix here. But I guess Madison realized that he could divert attention from that with the Bill of Rights?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly what he was doing. He wanted, first of all, we would call it today separating the leadership from the base. The Federalists had won a resounding victory in the first election to Congress, and they had a Federalist president in George Washington. He said, let's us pass the Bill of Rights. Let's us get credit for it as supporters of the federal government. Let's do the very thing that the Anti-Federalists kept saying, this is proof that we are going to be tyrannical. And so let's separate the leadership, like Samuel Adams and Mercy Otis Warren and Patrick Henry, from the average voter who was just sort of uncomfortable that there was no Bill of Rights, and were listening to the Anti-Federalists. Maybe we should have a second convention. Madison said, if we pass it and we get credit for it, then we will have crushed the support for the Anti-Federalists, and we will have avoided a second constitutional convention. The irony is that the other Federalists, when he proposed this, the other Federalists said, sit down, Madison. Be quiet. This is not important. We won the we have the Constitution. We won the Congress. We have to get on with more important things like deciding where the capital's going to be and deciding what the tonnage rates are going to be for imported French wine and deciding what we're going to tax and creating the judiciary. We can't be bothered with this thing. Madison was amazed. It took them really about a month and a half of the first session of Congress for them to realize that this was politically very astute. You can sort of watch, if you read the congressional debates, which you can do online. If you read the debates, you can see the light bulb going off over the heads of various Federalist congressmen, representatives, when they realize, oh, Madison, this is not a bad idea. But it takes weeks. For 6 weeks, they stall him. They say, sure, yeah, all right, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that later. And so it's sort of interesting to see them behaving just like political figures today, where you want to hit your head and say, stupid guys, don't you realize you should be doing this? Don't you realize it's a good idea?
Was the bulk of the debate over appending a Bill of Rights altogether, or was it over the content of each individual amendment?
It was both. Madison literally wanted to amend the Constitution, meaning he wanted to put it in Article 1, Article 2. He indicated exactly where all of the changes he wanted should go. Roger Sherman led the fight against this. He said the Constitution was passed and ratified by the people. You have no right to basically edit it, to rewrite it. Other people said this is a sacred document. We've got to make people revere it. You can't go fiddling with it. And Madison won right up until the very last minute. And then Roger Sherman proposed making them amendments again. And people voted yes to his proposal. They almost were edits to the Constitution, which would have really been had a different feel than being the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. But there were four amendments that were bitterly fought over. The first of these was what became the first. You know, there were 12 amendments. The first two didn't pass, and so everything got bumped up, what we call our First Amendment. The anti-federalists in the government tried to get included that the people have a right to instruct their representatives, tell them how they should vote, and the representatives had to vote that way. The Federalists said, absolutely not. First of all, it would hogtie people. But secondly, they said, representatives are chosen by the voters because they're wise and patriotic men. And they have to vote independently. They have to vote their own conscience. And that fight over whether representatives would be bound by what the voters said against representatives who were elected and then voted in what they thought was the best interest of the people was a fierce, fierce debate in the Congress. The second one was over the Second Amendment, but not at all what many people think. I read every word of the congressional debate. They do not say a single word about individual ownership of guns. They didn't say people can't own guns. They just don't say anything at all. What they want to do is guarantee that every state could maintain its own militia, that is, its own army, in case the federal government attacked them. And that's what people are concerned about. But the debates are hilarious because then they say, well, people who have religious opposition to violence, that is, people who are pacifists, and they talk about the Moravians more than the Quakers, and they say those people shouldn't be forced to be in the militias in the states. And somebody else says, But what if you're a Quaker and you want to be in the militia? You want to kill people. Does this mean they can't? Oh, they say, well, maybe we shouldn't name the religions that aren't required to serve in the militia. And someone else says, that's not fair. We really have to, if they don't want to fight, then they have to pay money so we can buy a substitute for them in the militia. And Roger Sherman gets up and he says, I'm paraphrasing, he says, guys, anybody who's a pacifist is not likely to contribute money so someone else can go kill people. I mean, this was a big debate and you thought, maybe I'm watching C-SPAN. Then my favorite comment was one of the representatives gets up and he says, oh, I think this is a terrible idea to exempt any religion, because we all know that people in America today, meaning 1789, are not religious. They're not going to church. They don't care about church. And if we're attacked by a foreign power, everyone is going to say they're a Moravian so they don't have to fight. I mean, and you think, oh dear, maybe all of these people were not geniuses. So the big fight is over whether pacifists can be exempt, whether they should be named. It is not over who should own a gun and who shouldn't own a gun. But it's a long argument. The next one was over a very important issue to Madison, and he loses on this. He wanted an amendment that said that the federal government had the power to step in if the states abused its citizens' liberties and rights. They voted this down. It's not till the 14th Amendment that we get that.
We're speaking this hour with Carol Berkin. She is presidential professor of history at Baruch College and a member of the history faculty of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Her new book is called The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Carol Berkin, presidential professor of history at Baruch College, also a member of the history faculty of the Graduate Center at City University of New York. Her new book is called The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Ed on the phone in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Ms. Berkin. Was there much discussion at this time about the need for a one national common language, i.e. English, which we've obviously pretty much evolved to. But it's my understanding that maybe half the people in the U.S. at that time were of German ancestry, what we would call Germany today or the Netherlands?
Oh, no, not that many people. There were certainly Germans in Pennsylvania, and there were some Germans who had traveled down to Virginia, but most Americans, other than African Americans, who by this time also spoke English, that is the enslaved peoples, most people were Scotch, Scotch-Irish, from Wales, from England. I don't think the kinds of social issues like that were not on their radar. They really did not think that government was supposed to do anything but protect the borders, maintain law and order, raise money, and regulate trade. They would be amazed at the kinds of things that since the New Deal, since the 20th century, we think government should be involved in. And so I can't imagine that that would have even crossed their mind to consider.
What sort of reaction do you have when people talk about the framers' intent as if you'd had, like, you know, a conference table of guys holding hands and nodding and smiling at each other?
It makes me crazy. The men who wrote the Constitution knew that things were going to change. They knew they had no idea what the country would be like in two generations. That's why they put in an amendment process. They thought people should be allowed to adapt their country's laws to what they needed at the time. Alexander Hamilton really puts it beautifully. He said, "We cannot let the people of the future be held in the icy grip of the past." So I maintain that this obsession with what did the founders mean. Can you imagine if any of them came back today, Ben Franklin came back today, he'd play with a light switch. He'd say, "On, off, on, off. Look what electricity has produced." They would be astounded to see women voting. They would be astounded to see slavery ended. They would be amazed to see a black president. They would be amazed to see 50 states, including Hawaii. They did not think that what they were doing, first of all, they did not think that what they were doing would last this long. Benjamin Franklin said, "If this Constitution saves this country for 10 years, we will have done our duty." So I think we should stop being obsessed with trying to read the tea leaves of what people who were dead, who lived in a completely different universe than we live in. I mean, a world in which distance and time and longevity and social behavior were really so different. Every historian usually has up somewhere in their office the phrase, "The past is a foreign country," by which they mean life has changed. And so trying to live as if you are James Madison, I think is an error. And so I like to think that the Constitution is a kind of organic, changing, adapting rule for the survival of the country.
We haven't done much to it, though. We've really made amendments very few and far between.
That's absolutely true. But what we have done is made major changes that are extra constitutional. There's not a word in the original Constitution about political parties. In fact, these men thought they were the worst, most terrible thing that could ever happen. Then, of course, by 1792, they'd organized two of them. There's nothing in there about seniority in the Senate. There's nothing in there about filibustering. There's nothing in there about education. There's nothing in there about the end of slavery. There are many things that have happened really outside of the Constitution. And that, I think, tells you something about the, in many ways, the minimalist nature of the Constitution. That's a sort of framework for government that gets filled in with policies, with programs, with social norms as they change, with rulings by the Supreme Court, which in 1789, the federal judiciary hadn't even been organized. So I think that what you see is that if these men had a real genius, it was to know not to create a Rube Goldberg elaborate machine that couldn't be worked around as society grew and changed.
What did it take to get the Bill of Rights actually ratified?
That's a good question. First of all, it had to get through the House of Representatives, which really took weeks and months. Then it went to the Senate. The Senate changed it. Madison was a very wordy guy. He had 39 pr- propositions. The House reduced it to 12. The Senate cleared up the language a lot. They believed in declarative sentences. Madison had really complicated sentences. And then it was sent to the states. And the state legislatures had to ratify these amendments. The fights in many of the states were quite extensive. By the end, three states did not ratify it. Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Georgia don't ratify the Bill of Rights until 1939.
Wow.
Massachusetts, because of some bureaucratic error, they vote yes, and then they forget to send the vote in. Georgia, because they really wanted a constitutional convention. It was a hotbed of anti-federalists. They really wanted to take away the taxing power, and they said, these are just marshmallow amendments. This is not what we want. The anti-federalists had a phrase for it, actually. The Federalists used it, too. They said, Jonathan Swift had written a satiric piece in which he said, whaling sailors, when they see a sea creature that could be dangerous, throw a tub out onto the water to distract the whale. And so people called the amendments a tub to a whale to distract the population. Because, in fact, as I had said before, until the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights had absolutely no power whatsoever. And the Bill of Rights does not actually become a viable, important part of the Constitution until the 1930s. That's when courts begin to cite the Bill of Rights. Judges begin to cite the Bill of Rights in their opinions. So it's passed in 1791, that is, the ratification is complete, and then it's completely ignored until the 14th Amendment, when it's used to protect voting rights for black men in the South, and then it sort of disappears again until the 20th century. And that tells you a lot about why people should study American history. Because if you stop the average person on the street, they would say, oh, yes, the Bill of Rights was written by the Constitutional Convention, and from the minute it was written, it became our most important statement of our rights and liberties. But actually, that's not true at all.
So you think Madison would be shocked to see this, the way that we revere the Bill of Rights today, and how often we refer to it?
I think he would be thrilled, because even though largely it was a political strategy on his part, Madison's a very complex man. He worried a lot, not about tyranny of the president. He worried about the tyranny of the majority against the minority. And he said, if we can get the majority people, that is the people who are the majority in the country, to internalize, he doesn't use that word, but that's what he meant, to internalize these values that are in the Bill of Rights, it will act as a brake on their impulse to oppress the minority. It will regulate them, but they have to believe it is what the country stands for. In essence, he's saying that people could be shamed into behaving like angels if they believed that what they were doing by oppressing other people was un-American. And we really do feel that way today. And I think he would be thrilled by that.
Is there something healthy about the tension that continues to exist between the powers of the state and the powers of the federal government?
Well, it keeps historians in business. There can be things that are very healthy about that. There can be things that are disastrous. I think federalism is what we have. Let me put it that way. It is It is the way our government is organized. And so we have to try to negotiate between state sovereignty and federal sovereignty. We have to keep calm about it and not be ideologues about it, which, of course, people tend to be often. But this is the system we have. If we want to abolish the states, like Hamilton suggested, then that'll solve the problem. If we want to abolish the central government, that would solve the problem. But here we are. This is what we have. And I think that it requires political wisdom to decide when to stand up for states' rights and when to stand up for federal rights. I'm glad I'm not in politics.
Carol, if there's a danger in lionizing the founders and sort of assuming that they were supernatural beings in terms of their wisdom and their devotion, how do we get right the amount of respect we have to hold for this document that they created that served us really pretty well for more than two centuries now, but still keep their ideas and their personal motivations in perspective?
Well, when I give a talk about this, I tell people, let's stop thinking about them as supermen. Let's stop calling them demigods, as Jefferson later called them. Let's stop saying they were all brilliant and they would have all gotten into early admission at Harvard and that they all would have scored perfect scores on the SATs. None of that is true. They weren't. There were maybe six brilliant men among them. And let's admire that ordinary people can do extraordinary things if they set their mind to it. I think that that's what makes them so admirable. They were scared. They were worried. They didn't know if what they were doing was right, but they persevered. They compromised at every turn. Watching them work through the record of that convention is so amazing. Nobody said, my way or the highway. They all said, look, the most important thing is saving this country. What can we do to do that? And I think that that puts a heavy burden on us today as ordinary people to try to solve the problems that our country faces in the same way, with the same genuine patriotism that I think the men that we call the Founding Fathers had.
Carol Burkin is presidential professor of history at Baruch College and a member of the history faculty of the Graduate Center at City University of New York. Her new book is The Bill of Rights, The Fight to Secure America's Liberties. Carol, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.